not just, our lectionary has this view, verses 1 through 15, and I'm going to sort of divide it up a little bit this morning. I want to take a look at this excerpt and also the conclusion to her story. So this morning your reading can be found on page 245 in your pew Bibles. But I ask that you set aside what you might already think you know about the story of David and Bathsheba, or what you might have in your head when you picture David or Bathsheba in this particular story. And as we read through the passage this morning and break it down over the next few minutes together, let's pay attention to what the text tells us and what it doesn't tell us. So I'll be reading 2 Samuel, starting at verse 1, and I'll read through verse 6, summarize the middle, and then pick back up with verse 24. I'm reading in the NRSV. In the spring of the year, the time when kings go out to battle, David sent Joab with his officers and all of Israel with him, and they ravaged the Ammonites and besieged Rabbah, but David remained in Jerusalem. And it happened late one afternoon, when David rose from his couch and was walking on the roof of the king's house, that he saw from the roof a woman bathing, and the woman was very beautiful. David sent someone to inquire about the woman, and it was reported, "This is Bathsheba, daughter of Eliam, the wife of Uriah the Hittite." So David sent messengers to take her, and she came to him, and he lay with her. Now she was purifying herself after her period. Then she returned to her house. The woman conceived, and she sent and told David, "I'm pregnant." So David sent word to Joab, "Send me Uriah the Hittite." And what happens next is Uriah gets sent back, and David spends a couple of days trying to convince Uriah to go home, presumably to sleep with his wife, so that there wouldn't be any concern about the fact that she's pregnant. People would think that it was Uriah's baby. But Uriah refuses to do so. And after being unable to convince Uriah to go back to his house, David eventually sends him back to the battlefield, carrying a message to Joab, the leader of the armies, telling Joab to place Uriah at the front of the battlefield so that he would be killed. So then Joab sends a messenger back to David to report about this, and that's where we're going to pick up in verse 24. "Then the archer shot at your servants from the wall. Some of the king's servants are dead, and your servant Uriah the Hittite is dead as well." David said to the messenger, "Thus you shall say to Joab, 'Do not let this matter trouble you, for the sword devours now one and now another. Press your attack on the city and overthrow it, and encourage Joab.'" But when the wife of Uriah heard that her husband was dead, she made lamentation for him. And when the mourning was over, David sent and brought her to his house, and she became his wife and bore him a son. But the thing that David had done displeased the Lord. The word of the Lord. In a wonderful paper by our own Karen Winslow entitled "The God of Knowledge Girds the Feeble with Strength," she provides a really helpful framework for viewing really all of Samuel and Kings. But specifically, she uses this as a framework to talk about Bathsheba. All the way back at the beginning of Samuel, when we're just at the start of the narrative that will eventually encompass David and Saul and Solomon and the rise and fall of the monarchy of Israel and Judah, we get Hannah's song after God hears her request for a son. And in her song, she praises God as the God of the unexpected, the God of the vulnerable, the God who makes low the powerful and raises up the weak and the lowly and the poor. And specifically in 1 Samuel 2, 3 through 4, we hear that the Lord is a God of knowledge, and by him actions are weighed. The bows of the mighty are broken, but the feeble or the powerless gird on strength. This is the story of Bathsheba, who goes from silent or mostly silent and without power in this story to one who will eventually shape the future of Israel. So I asked earlier that we set aside some of what we think we know about this passage, because if your context is anything like mine growing up, Bathsheba has often been portrayed as the instigator in this story. We might hear her as the one who set out to seduce David, or if not at least that extreme, she might be portrayed along with David as maybe lovers having some kind of romantic but adulterous affair. But I think you'll find that the text we read this morning actually says none of those things. Quite the opposite, in fact. So I want to spend some time this morning digging in a little deeper to the context of our passage. In the very first verse of this narrative, we see that David is in Jerusalem. but it's immediately contrasted with information about all of Israel and Joab being out fighting the Ammonites. It seems to give the impression that very few men are hanging out in Jerusalem still. And it also mentions that this was a time when kings were usually out leading their armies into battle. So it makes us sort of question, why is David even in Jerusalem? The text doesn't really tell us why he remained behind. But shouldn't he have been leading his armies like the kings were expected to do? That's why the people had requested a king back in 1 Samuel. They wanted a king to lead their armies, to be like the other nations. Yet this is exactly what David is not doing in our passage. And as we continue on, we get a little bit more information about David. While the Israelites are off fighting, David's got some free time on his hands. He's taken a nap, he decides to get up and walk along his roof, and it's here where David first sees Bathsheba. And instead of, I don't know, I would hope if it was any of us in this situation, you know, averting one's eyes, maybe deciding to walk the other way along his roof, going back inside, I don't know. David doesn't do that. He decides that she's beautiful and that he wants her. Verse 3 picks up with David inquiring about who this woman is. And it's interesting that she's labeled as the wife of Uriah the Hittite and the daughter of Eliam, not because she's linked with like the men and her relationship with them in her life, because that would have been normal. But it's interesting who the men are that are listed. There are many scholars that think that Uriah is the same Uriah that's mentioned later on in 2 Samuel 23 in the list of David's 30 mighty men of valor, right? This would be someone then who was the elite in David's army. So if the fact that she was married wasn't enough to discourage David, you would think at least knowing who she was linked with would have been a further check on him in following through with his desire. But David is a king, and he's in a position of power. And people do what he says. The author actually spends very little words or space describing what takes place in verses 4 through 5. But what we get is surprisingly abrupt, and it's full of verbs with David often as the subject of them. He sends, he takes, he lays. Things happen to Bathsheba in this passage. Could she have refused to go? The king of Israel had sent for her, and he didn't just send one messenger. It says he sends messengers, plural, multiple people to show up and ask her to come to the palace. It seems hard to imagine that she would have had a choice in this scenario. Did David simply think that because he was king, he could take what he wanted? He sends, he takes, he lays. It seems more like in this story that we're reading, that David is using his power to force a woman to sleep with him that he wanted. This doesn't sound like a consensual, romantic, but adulterous affair, but a horrible abuse of power. What we're reading sounds a lot more like a rape. But I want to pause briefly at verse 4 here. Some of our translations may have a variation of this passage which says, he sent messengers to get her, or he sent messengers to bring her to him. But what I think happens when we translate this passage this way, it softens the command that's being given. The word that's used here is one which more often than not is translated as take. And it's this very same word that back in 1 Samuel, when the people ask Samuel and God for a king, God through Samuel warns the people that what they don't know what they're asking for, right? Kings, Samuel says, will be takers. Kings will take your sons, they'll take your daughters, they'll take your livestock, and eventually they'll take you and turn you into slaves, because that's what kings and those in power do. And here we see David doing the same thing. He takes Bathsheba because he can. We get almost no action from Bathsheba in this passage until she finds out she's pregnant. And in somewhat of a reversal of David doing all of the sending so far, she sends him a messenger informing him that she's pregnant. And a sort of a side note, I found it was interesting that more often than not through this portion of the text, Bathsheba isn't called Bathsheba or the wife of Uriah, but simply as the woman. David has done what he wanted and casted her aside. She's just the woman. It's at this point in the story that David tries to cover up this abuse of power, but guess what? Abusing more of his power. He does more sending. This time he brings Uriah back from the battlefield. But when Uriah the Hittite, the outsider, or at least a descendant of outsiders, shows more understanding about what is right and what is wrong, David has him killed. But what about Bathsheba in all of this? When she hears of Uriah's death, the text doesn't tell us that she's pleased or that she's happy that she gets to go spend her life with the king now that everything is covered up. No, verse 26 tells us that she laments the death of her husband. This is a passionate expression of sorrow and grief. And what does she get afterwards? Yet again, David does more sending, and he has her brought to him afterwards and marries her. She gets to spend her life with a man who potentially abused her and killed her husband. Yay? No, not yay, because we immediately hear in verse 27 that the thing David had done displeased the Lord. Not the thing that Bathsheba had done, not the thing that they had done together, but the thing David had done. And this is further reinforced in chapter 12 when Nathan the prophet comes to confront David. He tells a parable about what the Lord is displeased with. And in the parable, it shows us that the displeasure is at the taking of an innocent lamb in the story, Bathsheba. The king has taken and done what is right in his own eyes, not the eyes of God. But this isn't the end of the story for Bathsheba. She returns again many years later in 1 Kings 1 through 2. And this is at the end of David's life at this point. The time has come for a new king to be selected. And this time, Bathsheba isn't silent. Things don't happen to her at this point in the story by people who have more power. And in a reversal of the 2 Samuel 11 story, the one who was powerful is now old and with a failing memory. And Bathsheba, the one who was previously without a voice, is now in a position of power and influence, and she speaks boldly. She convinces David that Solomon, her son, the youngest son, should be king, that David promised that, is what she says. This act likely not only saved the life of Solomon, but her own and potentially that of Nathan's as well. She changes the line of succession for the kings of Israel. And once Solomon is king, the text tells us she sits beside him in a position of respect and power. We often don't talk about the end of this story, but I think it shows us, as Karen's paper that I referred to early kind of frames this story, that the powerless, those who were powerless in this story, have indeed girded on strength. The unexpected people in the story have ultimately drastically shaped the future of Israel. So what does this mean for us? What do we do with this story and others like it? Today I want us to take away three things from this story. The first thing I want us to take away is that words are important, and how we describe things, especially as the church, matters. By referring to this story as often the headings of our Bibles do, as David commits adultery, and thankfully I looked in our pew Bibles, it does not title it that way, it just says David and Bathsheba. But by referring to those headings, which were placed afterwards, right, they're not a part of the original text. By calling it adultery, I think we do a disservice to Bathsheba. We alter the story in such a way that shifts what occurs. Adultery, in our maybe more modern context, often implies two mutually consenting individuals in a relationship outside of their marriage. But by labeling it as such, we distort the real sin and brokenness, I think, that's occurring in this passage. And we further compound that by trying to apply excuses for David that often blame Bathsheba, or at least give him a little of an out by placing blame on her end in the story. And I think by doing so, we also legitimize that type of rationalization in many situations of abuse and rape that women and men go through today. Yes, rape is a strong word for this story, but it is an accurate one. The passages of scripture we focus on matter. Even the ugly ones, the sad ones, the uncomfortable ones, and the horrifying ones. And these are many stories, not just this one, that we tend to ignore in the church, or at least retell them. But I think that these are many stories that instead we should sit with, we should mourn with for the brokenness in the world. For the brokenness in the world when people have and continue to do what is right in their own eyes and not what is right in the eyes of the Lord. The second thing I have is for those who may find themselves in positions of powerlessness. As Hannah's song reminded us at the beginning of this sermon and at the beginning of Samuel, this encompasses so much. The poor, the lowly, the outsider, the abused, the suffering, and the silenced. So today I want to say to you, if that is you, the Lord is a God of knowledge, and by him actions are weighed. The bows of the mighty shall be broken, but the feeble, the powerless, gird on strength. And we say that even if nowhere else, here, you have a voice. And the final thing I want us to consider today is that this text prompts us to question what we do with our own power. Many of us often find ourselves in positions of power and influence in some form or another in the things that we do in our lives. How are we using it? Will we be like Samuel warned, like David in our text, like kings and those in power who would be takers, ones who ignore or use others? Or will we speak on behalf of those in need? We are called to put hands and feet to the work of Christ. Let us as the church not be takers. Let us use our power in service to others as we make room here for the poor, the lowly, the outsider, the suffering, and the silenced. May we make room for their voices here. Let's spend the next few moments reflecting on.